You love your husband, the doctor?
Yes.
So why this?
He doesn't love me.
Hmm. So now you're taking your revenge? She looked at him in surprise.
No. I'm lonely. And I like you. The same reasons you're here, I would think.
Did you hope it was more complicated? Harry chuckled. No. That'll do fine.
Why did you kill him?
Who?
Are there more? The kidnapper, of course.
That's not important.
Maybe not. But I would like to hear you tell me.
She put her hand between his legs, cuddled up to him and whispered in his ear.
The details.
I don't think so.
I think you're mistaken.
Okay, but I don't like...
Oh, come on,
she hissed with irritation and gave his member a good, firm squeeze. Harry looked at her. Her eyes sparkled blue and hard in the dark. She put on a hasty smile and added in a sugary sweet tone,
Just for me.
Outside the bedroom, the temperature continued to fall, making the roofs in Bislett creak and groan while Harry told her the details and felt her stiffen, then take her hand away and in the end whisper she had heard enough. After she had left, Harry stood listening in his bedroom to the creaking and the ticking. Then he bent over the jacket he had thrown to the floor with all the other clothes in the stampede through the front door into the bedroom. He found the source in his pocket. Bjarne Mörler's parting gift. The watch glass glinted. He put it in the bedside table drawer, but the ticking followed him all the way into dreamland. He wiped the superfluous oil off the gun parts with one of the hotel's white towels. The traffic outside reached him as a regular rumble, drowning out the tiny TV in the corner with its mere three channels, a grainy picture, and a language he assumed was Norwegian. The girl in reception had taken his jacket and promised that it would be cleaned by early the following morning. He lined up the parts of the gun on a newspaper. When they had all been dried, he assembled the gun, pointed it at the mirror, and pulled the trigger. There was a smooth click, and he felt the movement of the steel components travel along his hand and arm. The dry click. The mock execution. That was how they had tried to crack Bobo. In November 1991, after 3 months of non-stop siege and bombardment, Vukovar had finally capitulated. The rain poured down as the Serbs marched into town. Along with the remnants of Bobo's unit, numbering around 80 weary and starving Croatian prisoners of war, he had been commanded to stand in line before the ruins of what had been the town's main street. The Serbs had told them not to move and had withdrawn into their heated tent. The rain had whipped down, making the mud froth. After 2 hours, the first men began to fall. When Bobo's lieutenant left the line to help one of those who had collapsed in the mud, a young Serbian private, just a boy, came out of the tent and shot the lieutenant in the stomach. Thereafter, no one stirred. They watched the rain obliterate the mountain ridges around them and hoped the lieutenant would soon stop screaming. He began to cry, but then he heard Bobo's voice behind him. Don't cry. And he stopped. Morning turned to afternoon, and it was dusk when an open jeep arrived. The Serbs in the tent rushed out and saluted. He knew the man in the passenger seat had to be the commanding officer, the Rock with the gentle voice, as he was called. In the back of the jeep sat a man in civilian clothing with a bowed head. The jeep halted right in front of their unit, and since he was in the first row, he heard the commanding officer ask the civilian to look at the prisoners of war. He recognized the civilian at once when he reluctantly raised his head. He was from Vukovar, the father of a boy at his school. The father scanned the lines of men, reached him, but there was no sign of recognition and he moved on. The commander sighed, stood up in the jeep and yelled over the rain, not using the gentle voice, Which of you goes under the codename of the Little Redeemer? No one in the unit moved. Are you frightened to step forward, Mali Spasite? You, who blew up 12 of our tanks and deprived our women of their husbands and made Serbian children fatherless? He waited. I thought so. Which of you is Bobo? Still no one moved. The commander looked at the civilian, who pointed a trembling finger at Bobo in the second row. Come forward, the commander shouted. Bobo walked a few steps to the jeep and the driver, who had got out and was standing beside the vehicle. When Bobo stood to attention and saluted, the driver knocked his cap into the mud. We have been given to understand, on the radio, that the Little Redeemer is under your command, the commander said. Please point him out to me. I've never heard of any Redeemer, Bobo said. The commander raised his gun and struck him. A red stream of blood issued from Bobo's nose.
Quick! I'm getting wet and food is ready. I am Bobo, a captain in the Croatian Army.
The commander nodded to the driver, who snatched Bobo's hair and turned his face to the rain, washing the blood from his nose and mouth down into the red neckerchief.
Idiot, said the commander. There is no Croatian army here, just traitors. You can choose to be executed right now or save us time. We'll find him, whatever happens.
And you'll execute us, whatever happens.
Bobo groaned. Of course.
Why?
The commando went through the motions of loading his gun. Raindrops fell from the gunstock. He placed a barrel against Bobo's temple.
Because I'm a Serbian officer, and the man has to respect his work. Are you ready to die?
Bobo shut his eyes. Raindrops hung from his eyelashes.
Where is the little redeemer? I'll count to three, then I'll shoot.
One, I am Bobo.
Two, captain in the Croatian army. Three.
Even in the pouring rain, the dry click sounded like an explosion.
Sorry, I must have forgotten to load the magazine, the commander said.
The driver passed the commander a magazine. He thrust it into the handle, loaded and raised the pistol again.
Last chance. One. My unit is two. The 1st Infantry Battalion in three.
Another dry click. The father in the back seat sobbed.
Goodness me! Empty magazine. Shall we try it with some of those nice shiny bullets in?
Magazine out. New one in. Load.
Where is the little redeemer? One.
Bobo mumbled the Lord's Prayer.
Otče naš. Two.
The skies opened. The rain beat down with a roar, as though in a desperate attempt to stop what they were doing. He couldn't stand it anymore. The sight of Bobo. He opened his mouth to scream that he was the little redeemer. He was the one they wanted, not Bobo. Just him. They could have his blood. But at that moment, Bobo's gaze swept across and past him, and he could see the wild, intense prayer in it, saw him shake his head. Then Bobo's body jerked as the bullet cut the connection between body and soul, and he saw his eyes snuff out and life drain away.
You,
shouted the commander, pointing to one of the men in the first row.
Your turn. Come here.
The young Serbian officer, who had shot the lieutenant, ran over.
There's some shooting up at the hospital,
he shouted. The commander swore and waved to the driver. The next moment the engine started with a roar, and the jeep vanished in the gloom. But not before he had told them there was no reason for the Serbs to worry. There were no Croatians in the hospital in a position to shoot. They didn't have any weapons. They had left Bobo where he lay, face down in the black mud. And when it was so dark that the Serbs in the tent could no longer see them, he crept forward, bent over the dead captain, loosened the knot, and took the red neckerchief. 8. Tuesday, December 16th. The mealtime. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and the day that would go down as the coldest December 16th in Oslo in 24 years was still as dark as night. Harry left the police station after going to Gert and signing out the key to Tom Voller's flat. He walked with upturned coat collar, and when he coughed, the sound seemed to disappear into cotton padding, as though the cold had made the air heavy and dense. People in the early morning rush hurried along the sidewalks. They couldn't get indoors quickly enough, whereas Harry took long, slow steps, bracing his knees in case the rubber soles of his Doc Martens didn't grip the packed ice. When he let himself into Tom Voller's centrally positioned bachelor flat, the sky behind Ekeberg Ridge was growing lighter. The flat had been sealed off in the weeks following Voller's death, but the inquiry had not thrown up any leads pointing to other potential arms smugglers. At least that was what the chief superintendent had said when he informed them that the case would be given a lower priority because of other pressing investigative tasks. Harry switched on the light in the living room and once again noticed that dead people's homes had a silence all their own. On the wall in front of the gleaming black leather furniture hung an enormous plasma TV, with 3-foot-high speakers on each side, part of the surround sound system in the flat. There were a lot of pictures on the walls with blue cube-like patterns. Raquel called it ruler and compass art. He went into the bedroom. Grey light filtered through the window. The room was tidy. On the desk there was a computer screen, but he couldn't see a tower anywhere. They must have taken it away to check it for evidence. However, He hadn't seen it among the evidence at HQ, although, of course, he had been denied access to the case. The official explanation was that he was under investigation by CIFO, the Internal Affairs Division, for the murder of Wöhler. Yet he could not get the idea out of his head that someone was not happy about every stone being turned over. Harry was about to leave the bedroom when he heard it. The deceased's flat was no longer quiet. A sound, a distant ticking, made his skin tingle and the hairs stand up on his arm. It came from the closet. He hesitated. Then he opened the closet door. On the floor inside was an open cardboard box, and he at once recognized the jacket Wöhler had been wearing that night in Kampen. At the top, in the jacket, a wristwatch was ticking. The way it had after Tom Wöhler had punched his arm through the window in the elevator door, into the elevator, where they were, and the elevator had started moving and had cut off his arm. Afterward they had sat in the elevator with his arm between them, wax-like and lifeless, a severed limb off a mannequin, with the bizarre difference that this one was wearing a watch. A watch that ticked, that refused to stop, but was alive, as in the story Harry's father had told him when he was small, the one where the sound of the dead man's beating heart would not stop, and in the end drove the killer insane. It was a distinct ticking sound, energetic, intense, the kind of sound you remember. It was a Rolex watch, heavy and in all probability exorbitantly expensive. Harry slammed the closet door, stamped his way to the front door, creating an echo against the walls, rattled the keys loudly when he locked up, and hummed in frenzied fashion until he was in the street, and the blissful traffic noise drowned out everything else. At 3 o'clock, shadows were already falling on 4 Commander T.I. Ørgrimsplass, and lights had started to come on in the windows of the Salvation Army headquarters. By 5 o'clock it was fully dark, and the mercury had dropped to 5 degrees Fahrenheit. A few stray snowflakes fell on the roof of the funny little car Martina Eckhoff sat waiting in. "Come on, Daddy," she mumbled as she glanced anxiously at the battery gauge. She was not sure how the electric car, which the army had been presented with by the royal family, would perform in the cold. She had remembered everything before locking the office, had entered information about upcoming and cancelled meetings of the various corps on the home page, revised the duty rosters for the soup bus and the boiling pot in Egertorge, and checked the letter to the office of the Prime Minister about the annual Christmas performance at Oslo Concert Hall. The car door opened, and in came the cold, and a man with thick white hair beneath his uniform cap and the brightest blue eyes Martina had seen, at any rate on anyone over 60. With some difficulty, he arranged his legs in the cramped footwell between seat and dashboard. "Let's go," he said, brushing snow off the emblem that told everyone he was the highest-ranking Salvation Army officer in Norway. He spoke with the cheeriness and effortless authority that are natural to people who are used to their commands being obeyed. "You're late," she said, "and you're an angel." He stroked her cheek with the outside of his hand, and his blue eyes were bright with energy and amusement. "Let's hurry now." "Daddy?" "One moment." He rolled down the car window. "Rickard!" A young man was standing in front of the entrance to the citadel, which was beside and under the same roof as the headquarters. He was startled, and rushed over to them at once, knock-kneed, with his arms pressed into his sides. He slipped and almost fell, but flapped his arms and regained balance. On reaching the car, he was already out of breath.
"Yes, Commander."
"Call me David, like everyone else, Rickard."
"All right, David, but not every sentence, please."
Rickard's eyes jumped from Commander David Eckhoff to his daughter, Martina, and back again. He ran 2 fingers across his perspiring top lip. Martina had often wondered how it was that someone could sweat so much in one particular area, regardless of weather and wind conditions, but especially when he sat next to her during a church service, or anywhere else, and whispered something that was supposed to be funny, and might have been just that, had it not been for the poorly disguised nervousness, the rather too intense nearness, and, well, the sweaty top lip. Now and then, when Rickard was sitting close to her and all was quiet, she heard a rasping sound as he ran his fingers across his mouth. Because, in addition to producing sweat, Rickard Nielsen also produced stubble, an unusual abundance of stubble. He could arrive at headquarters in the morning with a face like a baby's bottom, but by lunch his white skin would have taken on a blue shimmer, and she had often noticed that when he came to meetings in the evening, He had shaved again.
I'm teasing you, Rickard,
David Eckhoff smiled. Martina knew there was no bad intention behind them, these games of her father's, but sometimes he seemed unable to see that he was bullying people.
Oh, right, Rickard said, forcing a laugh.
He stooped. Hello, Martina.
Hello, Rickard,
Martina said, pretending to be concentrating on the battery gauge.
I wonder whether you could do me a favor,
the commander said.
There is so much ice on the roads now, and the tires on my car don't have studs. I should have changed them, but I have to go to the lighthouse.
I know, Rickard said with zeal. You have a lunch meeting with the Minister for Social Affairs. We're hoping for lots of press coverage. I was talking to the head of PR. David Eckhoff gave him a patronizing smile.
Good to hear you keep up, Rickard.
The point is that my car is here in the garage, and I would like to have studded tires put on by the time I return.
You know, are the tires in the trunk?
Yes,
but only if you have nothing more pressing going on. I was about to call John. He said he could...
No, no,
Rickard said, shaking his head vigorously. I'll fix them right away. Trust me, David.
Are you sure?
Rickard looked at the commander, bewildered.
That you can trust me?
That you don't have anything more pressing.
I'm sure. This is a good job. I like working on cars and
changing tires.
Rickard swallowed and nodded as the commander beamed. As he wound up the window and they turned out of the square, Martina said that she thought it was wrong of him to exploit Rickard's obliging nature.
Subservience, I suppose you mean,
her father answered.
Relax, my dear. It's a test, nothing more.
A test? Of selflessness or fear of authority?
The latter, the commander said with a chortle. I was talking to Rickard's sister, Thea, and she happened to tell me that Rickard is struggling to finish the budget for tomorrow's deadline. If so, he should make that a priority and leave this to John.
And then? Perhaps Rickard is being kind.
Yes, he is kind and clever, hard-working and serious. I want to be sure he has the backbone and the courage that an important post in management requires.
Everyone says John will get the post. David Eckhoff looked down at his hands with an imperceptible smile.
Do they? By the way, I appreciate your standing up for Rickard.
Martina did not take her eyes off the road, but felt her father's eyes on her as he continued.
Our families have been friends for many years, you know. They're good people, with a solid foundation in the army.
Martina took a deep breath to suppress her irritation. The job required one bullet. Nevertheless, he pushed all the cartridges into the magazine. First of all, because the weapon was in perfect balance only when the magazine was full, and because it minimized the chances of a malfunction. 6 in the magazine, plus 1 in the chamber. Then he put on the shoulder holster. He had bought it second-hand, and the leather was soft and smelled salty, acrid, from skin, oil, and sweat. The gun lay flat, as it should. He stood in front of the mirror and put on his jacket. It could not be seen. Bigger guns were more accurate, but this was not a case of precision shooting. He put on his raincoat, then the coat, shoved the cap in his pocket and groped for the red neckerchief in his inside pocket. He looked at his watch.
Backbone, said Gunnar Hagen, and courage. These are the qualities I seek above all else in my inspectors.
Harry didn't answer. He didn't consider it a question. Instead, he looked around the office where he had sat so often, like now. But apart from the familiar scenario of POB tells Inspector Watts what, everything had changed. Gone were Bjarne Müller's piles of paper, the Donald Duck comics squeezed between legal documents and police regulations on the shelf, the big photograph of the family and the even bigger one of a golden retriever the children had been given and long forgotten about, since it had been dead for 9 years, but which Bjarne was still grieving over. What remained was a cleared desk with a monitor and a keyboard, a small silver pedestal with a tiny white bone, and Gunnar Hagen's elbows, on which he was leaning at this very moment while eyeballing Harry from under his great thatched eyebrows.
But there is a third quality I prize even higher, Hole. Can you guess what it is?
No,
Harry said in an even monotone.
Discipline. Discipline.
The POB's division of the word into syllables suggested to Harry that he was in for a lecture on its etymology. However, Hagen stood up and began to strut to and fro with his hands behind his back, a sort of marking out of territory that Harry had always found vaguely risible. I'm having this face-to-face conversation with everyone in the section to make it clear what my expectations are.
Unit.
I beg your pardon? We've never been called a section, even though your rank used to be known as section head, PAS, just for your information. Thank you for drawing that to my attention, Inspector. Where was I?
Discipline.
Hagen bored his eyes into Harry, who didn't turn a hair. So the POB resumed his strutting. For the last 10 years, I have been a lecturer at the Military Academy. My area of specialty was the war in Burma. It may surprise you to hear that it has great relevance for my job here, Hole.
Well, Harry scratched his leg, you can read me like an open book, boss.
Hagen ran his forefinger over the window frame and studied the result with displeasure. In 1942, a mere 100,000 Japanese soldiers conquered Burma. Burma was twice the size of Japan, and at that time occupied by British troops, who were superior in numbers and firepower. Hagen raised his grubby forefinger, but there was one area where the Japanese were superior, and this made it possible for them to beat the British and the Indian mercenaries. Discipline. When the Japanese marched on Rangoon, they walked for 45 minutes and slept for 15. Slept on the road wearing their backpacks and their feet pointing toward their destination, so that they didn't walk into the ditch or in the wrong direction when they woke up. Direction is important, Hull. Do you understand? Harry had an inkling of what was to come. I understand that they made it to Rangoon, boss.
They did, all of them, because they did what they were told.
I have just been told that you signed out the keys to Tom Vola's flat.
Is that correct, Hull?
I took a look, boss.
For therapeutic reasons.
I hope so. That case is buried. Snooping around Vola's flat is not only wasted time, it also contravenes the orders you were given by the chief, and now by me. I don't think I need to spell out the consequences of refusing to obey orders. I might mention, however, that Japanese officers shot soldiers who drank water outside drinking times, not out of sadism, but because discipline is about excising the tumours at the outset. Am I making myself clear, Hull?
As clear as, well, something that is very clear, boss.
That's all for now, Hull. Hagen sat down on his chair, took a piece of paper from the drawer, and started to read with a passion, as though Harry had already left the office, and looked up in surprise when he saw Harry was still sitting in front of him.
Anything else, Hole?
I was wondering. Didn't the Japanese lose the war? Gunnar Hagen sat staring vacantly at the document long after Harry had gone. The restaurant was half full, as it had been the day before. He was met at the door by a young, good-looking waiter with blue eyes and blonde curls. He was so like Georgi that for a moment he stood there entranced, and on seeing the smile on the waiter's lips broaden, realized that he had given himself away. He took off his raincoat in the cloakroom and felt the waiter's eyes on him.
"Your name?"
the waiter asked. He mumbled his answer. The waiter ran a long, thin finger down the page of the reservations book. It stopped. "I've got my finger on you now," the waiter said, and the blue eyes held his gaze until he felt himself blushing. It didn't seem to be an exclusive restaurant, but unless his ability to do mental arithmetic had abandoned him, the prices on the menu were beyond belief. He ordered pasta and a glass of water. He was hungry, and his heartbeat was calm and regular. The other people in the restaurant were talking, smiling and laughing, as though nothing could happen to them. It had always surprised him that it was not visible, that he did not have a black aura, or that a chill, perhaps a stench of decay, did not radiate off of him, or to be precise, that no one else noticed. Outside, the town hall clock chimed its 3 notes 6 times. "Nice place," Taya said, looking around. The restaurant had uncluttered views, and their table gave on to the pedestrian walkway outside. From hidden speakers, there was the barely audible murmur of meditative New Age music.
"I wanted it to be special," John said, studying the menu. "What would you like to eat?"
Taya ran a quick eye down the single page.
"First, I need something to drink."
Taya drank a lot of water. John knew it was connected with diabetes and her kidneys.
It's not so easy to choose, she said. Everything looks good, doesn't it?
But we can't have everything on the menu.
No,
John swallowed. The words had just come out. He peeked up at her. Taya obviously hadn't noticed. All of a sudden she raised her head.
What did you mean by that?
By what? He asked in a casual manner.
Everything on the menu. You were trying to say something. I know you, John. What's up?
He shrugged. We agreed that before we get engaged, we would tell each other everything, didn't we?
Yes.
Are you sure you've told me everything? She sighed, resigned.
I am sure, John. I have not been with anyone. Not in that way.
But he could see something in her eyes, something in her expression he had not seen before. A muscle twitching beside her mouth, a darkening of her eyes, like an aperture closing, and he could not stop himself. Not even with Robert.
What?
Robert, I can remember you two flirting the first summer in Östgård.
I was 14 years old, John.
So? At first, she stared at him in disbelief. Then she seemed to churn inside. She closed up and cut him off. John grabbed her hand in both of his, leaned forward and whispered,
Sorry. Sorry, Taya. I don't know what came over me. Can we forget I asked?
Have you made up your minds? Both of them looked up at the waiter.
Fresh asparagus as a starter,
Taya said, passing him the menu.
Chateaubriand with porcini mushrooms for the main course.
Good choice. May I recommend a hearty, well-priced red wine we just got in?
You may, but water is fine,
she said with a radiant smile.
Lots of water.
John looked at her, admired her ability to hide her emotions. When the waiter had gone, Taya directed her gaze at John.
If you're finished interrogating me, what about yourself?
John gave a thin smile and shook his head.
You never did have a girlfriend, did you?
She said.
Not even at Östgård.
And do you know why? John said, placing his hand on hers. She shook her head.
Because I fell in love with one girl that summer,
John said, and regained her full attention.
She was 14 years old,
and I have been in love with her ever since. He smiled and she smiled, and he could see she had re-emerged from her hiding place, come over to where he was. Nice soup, said the Minister for Social Affairs, turning to Commander David Eckhoff, but loud enough for the assembled press corps to hear. Our own recipe, the commander said. We published a cookbook a couple of years ago we thought might be of... At a signal from her father, Martina approached the table and placed the book beside the minister's tureen. Some use, if the minister desired a good nutritious meal at home. The few journalists and photographers to turn up at the Lighthouse Cafe chuckled. Otherwise, attendance was sparse. A couple of elderly men from the hostel, a teary lady in a cape, and a junkie who was bleeding from the forehead and trembling like an aspen leaf in dread of going up to the field hospital, the treatment room on the second floor. It was not very surprising there were so few people. The lighthouse was not usually open at this time. However, a morning visit had not fit into the minister's schedule, so he did not see how full it normally was. The commander explained all of this, and how efficiently it was run, and how much it cost. The minister nodded at intervals. As, duty-bound, he put a spoonful of soup into his mouth. Martina checked her watch. 7:15. The minister's secretary had said 7 o'clock. They had to go.
That was delicious, the minister said. Do we have time to talk to anyone here?
The secretary nodded. Playing to the gallery, Martina thought. Of course they have time to talk. That's why they are here. Not to apportion funds. They could have done that over the phone. But to invite the press and show a minister for social affairs moving among the needy, eating soup, shaking hands with junkies and listening with empathy and commitment. The press aide signaled to the photographers that they could take photos, or, to be more precise, that she wanted them to take photos. The minister got to his feet and buttoned up his jacket as he scanned the room. Martina wondered how he would view his three options. The two elderly men looked like typical occupants of an old folks' home and would not serve the purpose. Minister meets drug addicts, or prostitutes, or something like that. There was something deranged about the injured junkie, and you can have too much of a good thing. But the woman, she seemed like a normal citizen, someone you could identify with and would like to help, especially if you heard her heart-rending story first.
Do you appreciate being able to come here? The minister asked, reaching out with his hand. The woman looked up at him. The minister said his name.
Pernilla,
the woman began, but was interrupted by the minister. Christian name's fine, Pernilla. The press is here, you know. They would like a picture. Is that okay with you?
Holman,
the woman said, sniffling into her handkerchief.
Pernilla Holman.
She pointed to the table where a candle burned in front of one of the photographs.
I'm here to commemorate my son. Would you mind, please, leaving me in peace?
Martina stood at the woman's table, while the minister plus retinue swiftly withdrew. She noted that they went for the two old men, after all.
I'm sorry about what happened to Per,
Martina said in a low voice. The woman peered up with a face swollen from crying, and from pills, Martina guessed.
Did you know Per?
She whispered. Martina preferred the truth, even when it hurt. Not because of her upbringing, but because she had discovered it made life easier in the long run. In the strangled voice, however, she could hear a prayer. A prayer for someone to say that her son was not only a drug-addicted robot, one less burden for society now, but a person someone could say he had known, been friends with, maybe even liked.
Fru Holman,
Martina said with a gulp,
I knew him, and he was a fine boy.
Pernilla Holman blinked twice and said nothing. She was trying to smile, but her attempts turned into grimaces. She just managed to say,
Thank you,
before the tears began to flow down her cheeks. Martina saw the commander waving to her from the table. Nevertheless, she sat down.
They took my husband, too,
Pernilla Holman sobbed.
What? The police. They say he did it.
As Martina left Pernilla Holman, she was thinking about the tall, blonde policeman. He had seemed so decent when he said he cared. She could feel her anger mounting, also her confusion, because she could not understand why she should be so angry at someone she didn't know. She looked at her watch. 5 minutes to 7. Harry had made fish soup, a Findus bag mixed with milk and supplemented with fish pudding and French bread, all bought at Niasi, the little grocery store that his neighbor from the floor below, Ali, ran with his brother. Beside the soup plate on the sitting room table was a large glass of water. Harry put a CD into the machine and turned up the volume, emptied his head and concentrated on the music and the soup. Sound and taste, that was all. Halfway into the soup and the third track, the telephone rang. He had decided to let it ring, but at the eighth ring he got up and turned down the music. Harry, it was Astrid.
What are you doing?
She spoke in a low voice, but there was still an echo. He guessed she had locked herself into the bathroom at home, eating and listening to music.
I have to go out, not far from you. Plans for the rest of the evening?
Yes. And they are? Listening to more music.
You make it sound like you don't want company.
Maybe. Pause. She sighed.
Let me know if you change your mind.
Astrid.
Yes?
It's not you, okay? It's me.
You don't need to apologize, Harry. If you're laboring under the illusion that this is vital for either of us, I mean. I just thought it could be nice.
Another time, perhaps.
Like when?
Like another time.
Another time, another life?
Something like that.
Okay. But I'm fond of you, Harry. Don't forget that.
When he had put down the phone, Harry stood without moving, unable to take in the sudden silence. Because he was so astonished. He had visualized a face when Astrid rang. The astonishment was not because he had seen a face, but the fact that it was not Raquel's or Astrid's. He sank into the chair and decided not to spend any more time reflecting. If this meant that the medicine of time had begun to work and that Raquel was on her way out of his system, it was good news. So good that he didn't want to complicate the process. He turned up the volume on his stereo and emptied his head. He had paid the bill. He dropped the toothpick in the ashtray and looked at his watch. 3 minutes to 7. The shoulder holster rubbed against his pectoral muscle. He took the photograph from his inside pocket and gave it a final glance. It was time. None of the other customers in the restaurant, not even the couple at the neighboring table, took any notice of him as he got up and went to the restroom.
He locked himself into one of the stalls, waited for a minute without succumbing to the temptation of checking that the gun was loaded. He had learned that from Bobo. If you got used to the luxury of double-checking everything, you would lose your sharpness. The minute had passed. He went to the cloakroom, put on his raincoat, tied the red neckerchief, and pulled the cap down over his ears. Opened the door onto Karl Johansgatte. He hurried up to the highest point in the street, not because he was in a rush, but because he had noticed that was how people walked here, the tempo that ensured you didn't stand out. He passed the garbage can on the lamppost where he had decided the day before that the gun would be dropped on the way back, in the middle of the busy pedestrian street. The police would find it, but it didn't matter. The point was that they didn't find it on him. He could hear the music long before he was there. A few hundred people had gathered in a semicircle in front of the musicians, who were finishing a song as he arrived. A bell pealed during the applause, and he knew he was on time. Inside the semicircle, on one side and in front of the band, a black cooking pot hung from three wooden sticks, and beside it, the man in the photograph. In fact, street lamps and two flashlights were all the light they had. But there was no doubt, especially since he was wearing the Salvation Army uniform, coat and cap. The vocalist shouted something into the microphone, and people cheered and clapped. A flash went off as they started up again. Their playing was loud. The drummer raised his right hand high in the air every time he hit the snare drum. He maneuvered his way through the crowd until he was standing about 9 feet from the Salvation Army man and had checked that his back was clear. In front of him stood two teenage girls, exhaling chewing gum breath into the freezing air. They were smaller than he was. He had no particular thoughts in his head. He didn't hurry. He did what he had come to do, without any ceremony. Took out the gun and held it with a straight arm. It reduced the distance to 6 feet. He took aim. The man by the cooking pot blurred into two. He relaxed, and the two figures merged back into one.
"Skull," John said. The music oozed out of the speakers like viscous cake batter.
"Skull," said Thea,
obediently lifting her glass to his. After drinking, they gazed into each other's eyes and he mouthed the words, "I love you." She lowered her eyes with a blush but smiled.
"I've got a little present for you," he said.
"Oh." The tone was playful, coquettish. He put his hand in his jacket pocket. Beneath the cell phone, he could feel the hard plastic of the jeweler's box against his fingertips. His heart beat faster. Lord above, how he had looked forward to, yet dreaded this evening, this moment. The phone began to vibrate.
"Anything the matter?" Thea asked.
"No, sorry. I'll be back in a sec."
In the bathroom, he took out the phone and read the display. He sighed and pressed the green button.
"Hi, sweetie. How's it going?"
The voice was jokey, as though she had just heard something funny that had made her think of him and then called on an impulse. But his log showed 6 missed calls.
"Hi, Runhill. Weird sound. Are you?"
"I'm in a bathroom, at a restaurant. Taya and I are here for a meal. We'll have to talk another time."
"When?"
"Another time."
Pause.
"Aha. I should have called you Runhill. There's something I have to tell you. I'm sure you know what."
He breathed in.
"You and I, we can't. John, it's almost impossible to hear what you're saying."
John doubted that was true.
"Can I see you tomorrow night at your place?"
Runhill said.
"Then you can tell me?"
"I'm not free tomorrow night, or any other.
Meet me at the Grand for lunch, then. I can text you the room number."
Runhill, not...
"I can't hear you. Call me tomorrow, John." "Oh, no, I'm in meetings all day. I'll call you. Don't switch your cell off, and have fun, sweetie."
"Runhill?"
John read the display. She had hung up. He could go outside and call back, get it over with. Now that he had started, that would be the proper thing to do, the wise thing to do. Give it the coup de grace. Kill it off. They were standing opposite each other now, but the man in the Salvation Army didn't appear to see him. His breathing was calm, his finger on the trigger. Then he slowly increased the pressure. And it flashed through his mind that the soldier showed no surprise, no shock, no terror. On the contrary, The light of understanding seemed to cross his face, as though the sight of the pistol gave him the answer to something he had been wondering about. Then there was a bang. If the shot had coincided with the bang on the snare drum, the music might have drowned it out, but, as it was, the explosion made many turn around and look at the man in the raincoat and his gun, and they saw the Salvation Army soldier, who now had a hole in the peak right under the A of his cap, fall backward as his arms swung forward like a puppet's. Harry jerked in his chair. He had fallen asleep. The room was still. What had woken him? He listened, but all he could hear was the low, reassuringly even rumble. No. There was another sound there, too. He strained to hear. There it was. The sound was almost inaudible, but now that he had identified it, it rose in magnitude and became clearer. It was a low ticking sound. Harry remained in his chair with closed eyes. Then a sudden fury surged through him, and without thinking, he had marched into the bedroom, opened the bedside table drawer, snatched Merla's wristwatch, opened the window and hurled it into the dark with as much force as he could muster. He heard the watch hit first the wall of the adjacent building and then the icy pavement in the street. He slammed the window shut, fastened the catches, went back to the sitting room and turned up the volume. So loud that the speaker membranes vibrated in front of his eyes, the treble was wonderfully bright in his ears, and the bass filled his mouth. The crowd had turned away from the band and looked at the man lying in the snow. His cap had rolled away and come to a halt in front of the singer's mic stand, while the musicians, who still had not realized what had happened, continued to play. The two girls standing closest to the man in the snow retreated. One of them started to scream. The vocalist, who had been singing with her eyes shut, opened them and discovered she no longer had the audience's attention. She turned and caught sight of the man in the snow. Her eyes sought a guard, an organizer, a gig manager, anyone who could deal with the situation. But this was just an ordinary street concert. Everyone was waiting for everyone else, and the musicians kept playing. Then there was a movement in the crowd, and people cleared a path for the woman elbowing her way through. "Robert!" The voice was rough and hoarse. She was pale and wore a thin black leather jacket with holes in the sleeves. She staggered through to the lifeless body and fell on her knees beside him. "Robert!" She placed a skinny hand against his throat. Then she turned to the musicians. "Stop playing, for Christ's sake!" One after another, the members of the band stopped playing. "The man's dying. Get hold of a doctor. Quick!" She put her hand back on his neck. Still no pulse. She had experienced this many times before. Sometimes it was fine. As a rule, it wasn't. She was confused. This couldn't be an overdose. A Salvation Army soldier wouldn't be doing drugs, would he? It had started to snow, and the snowflakes were melting on his cheeks, the closed eyes and the half-open mouth. He was a good-looking young man, and she thought now, with his face relaxed, he looked like her own boy when he was asleep. Then she discovered the single red stripe going down from the tiny black hole in his head, across the forehead and temple and into his ear. A pair of arms grabbed her and lifted her away, while someone else bent over the young man. She caught a last glimpse of his face, then the hole, and it occurred to her, with a sudden, painful certainty, that this fate was awaiting her boy, too. He walked at a fast pace. Not too fast. He wasn't fleeing. Looked at the backs in front of him, spotted someone hurrying and followed in his wake. No one had tried to stop him. Of course they hadn't. The report of a gun makes people stand back. The sight of it makes them run away. And in this case, most had not even absorbed what was going on. The final job. He could hear that the band was still playing. It had started to snow. Great. That would make people look down to protect their eyes. A few hundred yards down the street he saw the yellow station building. He experienced a feeling that he had from time to time, that everything was floating, that nothing could happen to him, that a Serbian T-55 tank was no more than a slow-moving iron monster, blind and deaf, and that his town would be standing when he returned home. Someone was standing where he was going to drop the gun. The clothes looked new and fashionable, apart from the blue sneakers, but the face was lacerated and scorched, like a blacksmith's, and the man, or the boy, or whatever he was, looked as if he were there to stay. He had stuffed his entire right arm into the opening of the green garbage can. Without slowing down, he checked his watch.
2 minutes since he had fired the shot, and 11 minutes to the departure of the train, and he still had the weapon on him. He walked past the garbage can and continued in the direction of the restaurant. A man came toward him, staring, but didn't turn after they had passed each other. He headed for the restaurant door and pushed it open. In the cloakroom area, a mother was bent over a boy, fiddling with a zipper on a jacket. Neither of them looked at him. The brown camel hair coat was hanging where it should be, the suitcase underneath. He took both into the men's restroom, locked himself into one of the two stalls again, took off his raincoat, put the hat in the pocket, and put on the camel hair coat. Even though there were no windows, he could hear the sirens outside. Many sirens. He cast around him. Must get rid of the gun. There wasn't a great deal of choice. He stood on the toilet seat, stretched up to the white ventilation gap in the wall, and tried to push the gun in there, but there was a grid inside. He stepped back down. He was breathing hard now, and getting hot inside his shirt. 8 minutes to the train. He could take a later one, of course. That wasn't critical. What was critical was that 5 minutes had passed, and he still hadn't got rid of the weapon, and she always said that anything over 4 minutes was an unacceptable risk. Naturally, he could leave the gun on the floor, but they always worked on the principle that the gun should not be found before he was safe. He left the stall and went to the sink, washed his hands while his eyes scrutinized the deserted room. Upamoch! And stopped at the soap container over the sink. John and Thea left the restaurant on Torgata with arms entwined. Thea let out a scream as she slipped on the ice under the treacherous new snow. She almost dragged John down with her, but he saved them at the last minute. Her bright laughter pealed in his ears.
"You said yes!"
he shouted to the sky and felt the snowflakes melting on his face.
"You said yes!"
A siren rang out in the night, several sirens. The sounds came from the direction of Karl Johansgata.
"Should we go and see what the fuss is?" John asked, taking her hand.
"No, John," said Thea with a frown. "Yes, come on, let's."
Thea dug her feet into the ground, but the slippery soles couldn't find any purchase.
"No, John."
But John just laughed and pulled her after him like a sled.
"No," I said.
The sound of her voice was enough to make John let go at once. He looked at her in surprise. She sighed.
"I don't want to see a fire right now. I want to go to bed, with you."
John studied her face.
"I am so happy, Thea.
You have made me so happy." He couldn't hear what she replied. Her face was buried in his jacket. Part 2. The Redeemer. 9. Tuesday, December 16th. The snow. The snow falling on Egertorga was stained yellow by the floodlights of the crime scene unit. Harry and Halvorsen stood outside the bar Tre Brudre, watching the spectators and the media pushing against the police barriers. Harry took the cigarette out of his mouth and gave a cough, throaty and moist.
"Lots of press," he said.
"They were here in no time," Halvorsen said. "Only a stone's throw from their offices, of course."
"Juicy number. Murder in the midst of the Christmas scramble on Norway's most famous street. A victim everyone has seen. The guy standing by the Salvation Army pot, while a well-known band is performing. What more can they ask for?"
"An interview with celebrity investigator Harry Hole?"
"We'll stay here for the moment," Harry said.
"What was the time of the murder?"
"A little after 7. Harry looked at his watch. "That's almost an hour ago. Why didn't anyone call me before?"
"Dunno. I got a call from the POB a little before 7:30. I thought you would be here when I arrived."
"So you called me on your own initiative?"
"Well, you're like the inspector, after all."
"Like?"
Harry mumbled, flicking the cigarette to the ground. It melted its way through the light covering of snow and vanished. "All the evidence will soon be under a foot of snow," Halvorsen said. "Typical."
"There won't be any evidence," Harry said.
Beata was walking toward them with snow in her blonde hair, holding a small plastic bag between her fingers with an empty casing inside.
"Wrong,"
Halvorsen said to Harry with a triumphant smile.
9mm. Beata said, grimacing. "Most common ammo around. And that's all we've got."
"Forget what you have or haven't got," Harry said.
"What was your first impression? Don't think, speak."
Beata smiled. She knew Harry now. First, intuition,
then the facts. Because intuition provides facts, too. It's all the information the crime scene gives you, but which the brain cannot articulate right away.
Not a great deal. Egertorge is the busiest square in Oslo. Hence we had an extremely contaminated scene, even though we arrived 20 minutes after the man was killed. But it seems professional. The doctor is looking at the victim now. It looks like he was hit by one bullet. Right in the forehead. Pro. Yes, that's my instinct.
Working by instinct, are we, Inspector?
All three turned around to the voice behind them. It was Gunnar Hagen. He was wearing a green military jacket and a black wool cap. The smile was visible only at the corners of his mouth.
We try anything that works, boss, Harry said. What brings you here?
Isn't this where it happens?
In a way.
Bjarne Møller preferred the office, I gather. As for me, I believe that a leader should be in the field. Was more than one shot fired?
Halvorsen?
Halvorsen flinched. Not according to the witnesses we've spoken to. Hagen stretched the fingers of his gloves.
Description?
A man. Halvorsen's eyes flitted between the POB and Harry. That's all we know so far. People were watching the band and the whole thing happened very quickly.
Hagen sniffed. In a crowd like this, someone must have got a good look at the gunman.
You would think so, Halvorsen said, but we don't know for certain where the man was standing.
I see.
Again, the tiny smile.
He was standing in front of the victim, Harry said. Distance of 6 feet, maximum.
Oh?
Hagen and the other two turned to Harry. A gunman knew that if you want to kill someone with a small-caliber weapon, you shoot him in the head, Harry said. Since he fired only one shot, he was sure of the result. Ergo, he must have been standing so close that he could see the hole in the forehead and know that he hadn't failed. If you examine his clothes, you should be able to find a fine gunshot residue that will prove what I am saying.
Maximum, 6 feet. Closer to 5, Beata said. Most guns eject the shell casing to the right, but not very far. This was found trampled into the snow 4 feet 9 inches from the body, and the dead man had singed woolen threads on his coat sleeve. Harry studied Beata. It was not primarily her innate ability to distinguish faces he appreciated, but her intelligence, zeal, and the idiotic notion they shared, that the job they did was important. Hagen stamped his feet in the snow.
Well done, Lern. But who on earth would shoot a Salvation Army officer?
He wasn't an officer, Halvorsen said. Just a normal soldier. Officers are permanent. Soldiers are volunteers or work on contracts. He flipped open his notepad. Robert Carlson, 29 years old, single, no children.
Not without enemies, it seems, Hagen said.
Now what do you say, Lern? Beata didn't look at Hagen, but at Harry, as she answered. It might not have been directed at the individual.
Oh? Hagen smiled. Who else could it have been directed at?
The Salvation Army, perhaps?
What makes you think that?
Beata shrugged. Controversial views, Halvorsen said. Homosexuality, women priests, abortion, perhaps some fanatic or other.
The theory has been noted, Hagen said. Show me the body.
Both Beata and Halvorsen sent Harry a quizzical look. Harry nodded toward Beata.
Jeez,
Halvorsen said when Hagen and Beata had gone. Is the POB intending to take over the investigation? Harry, his eye on the cordon where the media photographers were lighting up the winter darkness with their flashes, rubbed his chin, deep in thought.
Pro,
he said.
What?
Beata said the perp was a pro. So let's start there. What's the first thing a pro does after a murder?
Makes his escape?
Not necessarily. But at any rate, he gets rid of anything that can link him to the shooting.
The weapon.
Right. I want all repositories, containers, garbage cans, and backyards in a 5-block radius of Egertorge checked. Now. Request uniformed backup if necessary.
Okay.
And get all the video cassettes from surveillance cameras in shops in the area from before 7 o'clock to well after.
I'll get Skara to do that.
And one more thing. Doug Blader also has a hand in organizing the street concerts, and they write articles about them. Check whether their photographer took any pictures of the spectators.
Of course.
I hadn't thought of that. Send the photos to Beata for her to take a look. And I want all the detectives assembled in the meeting room in the red zone at 10 tomorrow. Will you contact them?
Yes.
Where are Lee and Lee?
They're questioning witnesses at the station. A couple of girls were standing next to him when he fired.
Okay. Ask Ola to make a list of family and friends of the victim.
That's where we'll start to see if there are any obvious motives.
I thought you said this was the work of a pro.
We have to keep several balls in the air at once, Halverson, and start looking wherever it seems promising. Family and friends are easy to find, as a rule. 8 out of 10 murders are committed by someone who knows the victim. Halverson sighed. They were interrupted by someone calling Harry Hole. They turned in time to see the press bearing down on them through the snow.
Showtime, Harry said. Point them to Hagen. I'm headed for the station.
The suitcase had been checked in with the airline and he was walking toward security. He was in high spirits. The final job was done. He was in such a good mood that he decided to run the gauntlet. The woman at security nodded her head when he took the blue envelope from his inside pocket to show his ticket.
Cell phone? She asked.
No. He put the envelope on the table between the X-ray machine and the metal detector while taking off his camel hair coat, discovered he was still wearing his neckerchief, removed it and put it in the pocket, placed the coat in the tray the official gave him, and walked through the detector, watched by 2 additional pairs of alert eyes. Including the man screening his coat and the one at the end of the conveyor belt, he counted 5 security people whose sole job it was to make sure he didn't take anything with him that could be used as a weapon on board the plane. On the other side of the detector, he put on his coat and went back to collect his ticket on the table. No one stopped him, and he walked past the officials. That is how easy it would have been to smuggle a knife blade through in the envelope. He emerged into the large departure hall. The first thing that struck him was the view from the enormous panoramic window. There wasn't one. The snow had drawn a white curtain in front of the scene outside. Martina sat bent over the steering wheel as the windshield wipers swished the snow away.
The minister was positive, David Eckhoff said with satisfaction. Very positive.
You already knew that, Martina said. People like that don't come for soup and invite the press if they're going to say no. They want to be re-elected.
Yes, Eckhoff said with a sigh. They have to be re-elected.
He looked out the window.
Good-looking boy, Rickard, isn't he?
You're repeating yourself, Daddy.
He just needs a bit of guidance to be a really good man for us.
Martina drove down to the garage under the headquarters and pressed the remote control. The steel doors jolted open. They rumbled in and the studded tires crunched over the concrete floor of the empty parking garage. Beneath one of the roof lights, beside the commander's blue Volvo, stood Rickard, wearing overalls and gloves. But it wasn't him she was looking at. It was the tall blonde man standing next to him. She recognized him instantly. She parked alongside the Volvo, but sat in the car searching for something in her bag while her father got out. He left the door open and she heard the policeman say,
Eckhoff.
The sound echoed off the walls.
That's right. Anything I can help you with, young man?
The daughter recognized the voice her father had assumed, the friendly but authoritative commander's voice.
My name is Inspector Harry Hole, Oslo District. It's about one of your employees.
Robert. Martina could feel the policeman's eyes on her as she got out of the car.
Carlson,
Hole went on, turning back to the commander.
A brother,
David Eckhoff said.
I beg your pardon. We like to think of our colleagues as members of a family.
I see. In that case, I'm afraid I have to announce a death in the family, Herr Eckhoff. Martina felt her chest constrict. The policeman waited to let it sink in before continuing. Robert Carlson was shot dead in Egertorge at 7 o'clock this evening.
Good God!
Her father exclaimed.
How?
All we know is that an unidentified person in the crowd shot him and fled the scene. Her father shook his head in disbelief.
But at 7 o'clock, you say? Why haven't I been told until now?
Because there are routine procedures in cases like these, and we inform relatives first. I regret to say we have not been able to get hold of them. Martina realized from the detective's factual, patient response that he was accustomed to people reacting to news of bereavement with that kind of irrelevant question.
I understand,
Eckhoff said, blowing out his cheeks and then releasing the air through his mouth.
Robert's parents don't live in Norway anymore, but you must have contacted his brother, John.
He's not at home, and he isn't answering his cell phone. I was told he might be here at headquarters, working late. However, the only person I've met is this young man. He nodded toward Rickard, who was standing there with glazed eyes like a dejected gorilla,
arms limp, hanging down by his sides and capped off with enormous specialist gloves, sweat gleaming from his blue-black top lip.
"Any idea where I can find the brother?" the policeman asked. Martina and her father looked at each other and shook their heads.
"Any idea who would want to take Robert Carlson's life?"
Again, they shook their heads.
"Well, now you know. I need to get going, but we would like to come back to you with more questions tomorrow."
"Of course, Inspector," the commander said, straightening up.
"But before you go, might I ask you for more details about what has happened?
Send me a text. I have to go."
Martina watched her father's face change color. Then she turned toward the policeman and met his gaze.
"I apologize," he said. "Time is an important factor in this phase of the investigation."
You could try my sister's place, Thea Nielsen."
All three of them turned to Rickard. He gulped.
"She lives in the army building on Göteborgata."
The policeman nodded. He was about to go when he turned back to Eckhoff.
"Why don't the parents live in Norway?"
"It's a long story. They lapsed."
"Lapsed?"
"They abandoned their faith. People brought up in army ways often find it difficult when they choose a different path."
Martina observed her father, but not even she, his daughter, could detect the lie in his granite features.
The policeman moved off, and she felt the first tears flow. After the sound of his footsteps had faded away, Rickard cleared his throat.
"I put the summer tires in the trunk."
By the time the announcement finally came over Gardermoen Airport's PA system, he had already guessed. "Due to weather conditions, the airport has been temporarily closed."
"Matter of fact," he said to himself,
like an hour before, when the first announcement was made about the delay due to snow. They had waited while the snow laid thick blankets over the aircraft outside. He had kept an unconscious eye on uniformed personnel. They would be uniformed at an airport, he imagined. And when the woman in blue behind the counter by gate 42 lifted the microphone, he could see it written all over her face. The flight to Zagreb was cancelled. She was apologetic. Said it would depart at 10:40 the following morning. There was a collective but muted groan from the passengers. She went on that the airline would cover the cost of the train back to Oslo and a room at the SAS Hotel for transit passengers and those travelling on a return ticket. Matter of fact, he thought once more, as the train flew through the blackened night landscape. It stopped just once before Oslo, at an assortment of houses on white terrain. A dog sat shivering under one of the benches on the platform as the snow drifted in cones of light. It looked like Tinto, the playful stray that had run around the neighborhood in Vukovar when he was small. Georgi and a couple of the other older boys had given it a leather collar inscribed, "Name, Tinto, owner, Svi, everyone." No one had wished Tinto any harm. No one. Sometimes that wasn't enough. John had moved to the end of the room that was not visible from Taya's front door while she went to open it. It was Emma, the neighbour.
"I'm so sorry, Taya, but this man needs to get hold of John Carlson as a matter of urgency."
"John?" A man's voice. "Yes, I've been informed that I might be able to find him at this address with a Taya Nielsen. There were no names downstairs by the bells, but this lady has been very helpful."
"John, here? I don't know how..."
"I'm from the police. My name is Harry Hall. It's about John's brother."
"Robert?"
John stepped toward the door. A man of his height with bright blue eyes looked at him from the doorway. "Has Robert done something wrong?" he asked, trying to ignore the neighbor who was standing on tiptoes to see over the policeman's shoulder.
"We don't know," the man said. "May I come in?"
"Please do," Taya said.
The detective stepped inside and closed the door in the neighbor's disappointed face.
"I'm afraid it's bad news. Perhaps you ought to sit down."
The three of them sat around a coffee table. It was like a punch to the stomach, and John's head shot forward in automatic response to what the policeman told him.
"Dead?"
he heard Taya whisper.
"Robert?"
The policeman cleared his throat and continued talking. The words seemed like dark, cryptic, barely comprehensible sounds to John. All the time he was listening to the detective explaining the circumstances, he was focusing on one point, on Taya's half-open mouth and sparkling lips, moist, red. Her breathing came in short, rapid pants. John didn't notice that the policeman had stopped speaking until he heard Taya's voice.
"John?"
He asked you a question. Sorry. What did you say?
I know this is a difficult time, but I was wondering whether you know of anyone who might have wished to kill your brother.
Robert?
Everything around John seemed to be happening in slow motion, even the shake of his head.
Right,
the policeman said, without making a note on the pad he had just produced. Is there anything in his job or private life that might have made him enemies? John heard his own inappropriate laughter.
Robert's in the Salvation Army, he said. Our enemy is poverty, material and spiritual. It's rare for any of us to be killed.
That's the job. What about private life?
What I said applied to both job and private life.
The policeman waited.
Robert was kind,
John said, and heard his voice starting to disintegrate.
Loyal. Everyone liked Robert.
His voice thickened and stopped. The policeman looked around the room. He didn't seem comfortable with the situation, but he waited and waited. John kept swallowing.
He could be a little wild now and then, a bit impulsive. Some may have considered him a little cynical, but that was the way he was. Deep down, Robert was a harmless boy.
The policeman turned to Thea and looked down at his notes. You're Thea Nielsen, sister of Rickard Nielsen, I gather. Does this tally with your impression of Robert Carlson? Thea shrugged.
I didn't know Robert so well.
She had crossed her arms and avoided John's gaze.
He never hurt anyone, as far as I am aware.
Did Robert ever say anything that might suggest he was in conflict with anyone? John shook his head hard, as though there was something inside he was trying to get rid of. Robert was dead. Dead. Did Robert owe any money?
No. Yes, me. A little.
Sure he didn't owe anyone else money.
What do you mean?
Did Robert take drugs? John stared at the policeman in horror, then replied,
No, he did not.
How can you know for sure? It's not always.
We work with drug addicts. We know the symptoms. And Robert didn't take drugs, okay?
The policeman nodded and took notes. Sorry, but we have to ask these things. Naturally, we cannot exclude the possibility that the man who fired the gun was insane and Robert was an arbitrary victim. Or, since the Salvation Army soldier standing by the Christmas pot is a symbol, that the killing was directed against your organization. Are you aware of anything that would support the latter theory? As though synchronized, the two young people shook their heads. Thank you for your help. The policeman stuffed the notepad in his coat pocket and stood up. We haven't been able to find a telephone number or address for your parents.
I'll take care of that,
John said, staring into empty space.
Are you quite sure?
Sure about what?
That it is Robert?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
But that's all you're sure about, Thea burst out. Otherwise you know nothing.
The policeman paused in front of the door and considered her comment. I think that's a fairly accurate summary of the situation, he said. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the snow stopped. The clouds that had been hanging over the town like a heavy black stage curtain were drawn to one side, and a large yellow moon made its appearance. The temperature beneath the naked sky began to fall again, making house walls creak and groan. 10. Wednesday, December 17th. The Doubter. The seventh day before Christmas Eve broke with such freezing temperatures that people on the streets of Oslo felt they were being squeezed by a steel glove as they hurried in silence, focused on one thing, to arrive and escape its icy grip. Harry was sitting in the meeting room in the red zone at Police HQ, listening to Beate Lern's demoralizing report while trying to ignore the newspapers in front of him on the table. They all had the murder on the front page. They all had a grainy photo of a winter dark Egger Torga, with references to two or three pages of articles inside the paper. Ferdinandsgang and Dagbladet